Blog Talk Radio.
You have made it to Stu and the Nun, an online radio show that looks to inform, educate, and hopefully make you laugh. Stu and the Nun is a show focused on national security, policy, politics, and selfless service. We do this by not only interviewing guests, but also sharing our perspectives and asking you, the listener, to interact with us on our show chat room, via our Facebook page, and on Twitter.
Welcome to Stu and the Nun. No words could be a better intro than what we just heard from Madison Rising. You know, the American dream, the American way of life, it's under attack, and we know that specifically due to the events that happened over the weekend. But before we get into that, today's the 14th of June, 2006. This is our 43rd episode. Pretty exciting stuff for us. We're almost a year under the new banner of Stu and the Nun. We're pretty excited. The Stu is out there working tonight. He's actually coincidentally schmoozing and doing the voodoo that he does so well in the great state of Texas, the Republic of, in the capital of the Republic, at downtown Austin, while I am in Georgetown, Austin, broadcasting to you live from Fire and Ice Pizza, Georgetown. We've done previous shows at Fire and Ice in Round Rock. This is a great little local chain that have popped up. Some great guys, Chippy and Adam, that are doing great things, you know, and make, one, an amazing pizza, and two, you know, it's great to see the American Dream Alive guys, you know, like following their dreams and doing great stuff. But we got a great show for you tonight. Like I said, Stu's out for a little bit, so you just got the Nun, but that's okay because the bald power of one is equal to the haired power of five. Today is a special day. In 241 years of the past, one of the greatest institutions, one of the most important institutions in the United States, which helped create the United States, the United States Army was born, written in and created and founded on this day 241 years ago, and going strong. Now, there's a lot of debate about the social future of the United States Army with the inclusion of women in combat roles and the diminishment of budgeting and, you know, the lobby of, you know, politically correctness. But, you know, it's those brave men and women that tonight are on the lines out in Afghanistan, in Africa, in South America, in 17 countries, you know, globally, the nation's best stand willing and ready and working tonight. While some of the nation's best here at home did work on over the weekend, a big shout out to the Orlando SWAT team. I got a really good friend of mine, Officer Kevin Franks. He's a staff sergeant in the Florida National Guard. Great, great human being. One of the best that I've ever had the pleasure of serving with. Sergeant First Class. And, you know, he's a member of the Orange County Sheriff's Department down there, working in the Orlando area. Many people know that I was stationed down there and served with the Florida National Guard for a short period of time there with the two of the 124, one of the most amazing non-regular units in the arsenal, storied unit, the Seminoles, an amazing unit. But, you know, it's just heartbreaking to see and hear the news, you know, getting up Sunday morning and going to church and, you know, just enjoying the time I have with my family and thinking about all the great things and listening to the message was awesome. And to get out to start getting messages after I turned my phone on after church, And just seeing the messages flooding in from people in Orlando, family members of my wife that live in Orlando, people checking in to make sure that they're safe. You know, just really captured the attention of like how fleeting life is and how quick it is and how we are so very vulnerable here at home. The national narrative immediately took off. You know, as soon as we got going, got back, I started pulling up the news, and you know, I had a good 45 minutes of news coverage under my belt before the president came on and made a statement. And wow, like how quickly, you know, the reporting is. And part of the problem with the speed at which things are reported is the lack of accuracy. The first thing, you know, that, you know, is being reported is that, you know, this assault rifle, the quote, weapon of war, end quote, that keeps being referenced was, you know, the tool of choice. You know, slowly but surely that's coming out. The first time I saw it was today, actually, that was not the weapon of choice. In fact, it was a very specific SIG model that, you know, has one purpose only. An AR-15 has multiple purposes, although a lot of people think the AR stands for assault rifle. It doesn't, actually. The AR stands for Armalite, which is the company that created the weapon platform and then sold it to Colt, who went into mass production and sold it as part of a DOD contract to the United States Army and Marine Corps. Yeah, Armalite, which is what the AR stands for, and it's model number 10 and it's model number 15. Different barrel lengths and different calibers, and you know, but you know, it's quick that the narrative gets pushed. What is also interesting is you know, how quickly this went from a potential hate crime to seeing how it was actual terrorist activity, a terrorist attack. You know, you always hear reports, and you know, deep down, I never want to believe it. But anytime someone says like a shooter was screaming like Allah Akbar or something like that, you know, like I immediately grow pause and, you know, wait till I get confirmation that that's actually what happened. I think people, you know, are quick to report inaccuracies, and I wanted to make sure that was accurate, and it was. Apparently, this gentleman called in and, you know, pledged allegiance to ISIS over a formal channel, I guess 911, claiming allegiance to al-Baghdadi, and then, you know, going in there and putting in, you know, just an intense amount of fire. When you think about, you know, the number perished versus the number wounded, usually the wounded number is substantially greater than the perished number. In this case, it sadly was not. They're almost equal in number. In fact, as the numbers are being adjusted, it appears like the number of perished versus wounded is actually, one's going to outweigh the other. So a horrible situation, but great work on the Orlando Police Department's entry team. You know, I've heard people talking and, you know, complaining about the fact that it took, you know, a couple hours for them to get in there. But, you know, when you're dealing with something and you're collecting all these facts, you know, reports of a suspicious advice device, you just don't want to like rush in there, and you got to take a tactical pause and be smart about it. But, you know, great work on their part, you know, to utilize the tools that they have. There's this picture about the ballistic helmet with the one officer took, you know, a shot right to the forehead. And, you know, like, is, you know, here to pose with pictures and, you know, praise the power of the Kevlar. And I got to tell you, like, where people say, like, hey, the Army doesn't require this, correction, the police don't require the equipment that the Army requires. Apparently, they've never engaged in armed combat. And police are no different than the military. We look at what happens on our border in terms of, you know, aggressive act coming from, you know, criminal elements. We'll say drug dealers, drug peddlers, pushers, transporters, money laundering. You know, like obviously, you know, they want to protect that, so they're not protecting it with slingshots. This isn't David versus Goliath. This is actual armed combat with a two-way live fire. And those that protect us every day, they deserve to have the equipment to defend themselves against what they're up against. And, you know, you can say that the only reason the bad guys have guns is because of loopholes and gun shows or failed background checks. Well, there's some accuracy to the failed background check. If a guy's on a no-fly list and the FBI have investigated him for several years, he probably shouldn't be able to purchase legally any weapon. However, whether he wants to do it legally or illegally, there's nothing to stop the guy. So let's keep it real and let's use common sense. And, you know, that is that, you know, whether we'd like to admit it or not, those weapons are available. You go to countries like Australia where they've had extremely strict gun control, there's still gun violence there. And, you know, where did those guns come from? You know, they didn't just magically appear. There's obviously something that we can do as a society to help fight this and combat this. But the last two major incidences, one being San Bernardino, the other one being Orlando, it's pretty obvious that this is, you know, terroristic in design, it's terroristic in planning, and it's terroristic in execution. And they don't play by the rules. That's why it's terrorism. The use of you know, violence to achieve a political gain. It is what it is. We need to fight terrorism. You know, like gun control is a moot point when you have people willing and able to do anything to terrorize and inflict violence upon for a political gain. The fact that we're not saying that this is, you know, a form of radicalized Islamic terrorism as a national narrative is also kind of disheartening. And I'm not saying that because I'm a Christian. I'm saying that as a North American, as a Westerner, a believer in Western culture, a follower of Christian belief, we should be able to call a spade a spade. When Timothy McVeigh bombed Oklahoma City, we were quick to say that he was radicalized. You know, when David Koresh, you know, like, you know, besieged the town of Waco, we were quick to identify his perversion of, you know, Christianity. So we shouldn't be afraid to say, like, hey, the root of this is that. So the if I could just take a second and just say, like, man, you know, I really wish the national narrative could change. Sorry, I'm trying to get our man David Dunphy on the line, and I'm pretty excited about him being on the air tonight, and that's because he's got a new book coming out, and he's going to be an interesting guest. And we also got Omar Avila on the show tonight. I didn't mean to like go off on a 15-minute tirade, but you know, it's an interesting time, and I really wish that, you know, we'd identify what we're facing. You know, there are guys out there that are beating the drum really hard and trying to remind everybody, and it's really cool to see that. But before we run out of time, I really want to bring on tonight's guest, Mr. Dunphy. He's got a great book coming out called The Iron Major Survival Guide. For those of us that served in the military, there was great opportunities at stores to like kind of pick up some of the books to help us along with our career. But when you get in the senior ranks, believe it or not, those numbers of books diminish, and people it seem like are fearful to write and share their secrets. But Dave's gone out and done it. We're really excited. I believe Greybeard Books is the publisher. So everyone knows how we feel about booksbyveterans.com here on the Stew and the Nun. So, Dave, welcome to the show, my man. How are you tonight?
Hey, good, Toby. Thanks, man. Glad to be on here tonight.
Well, I'm glad you made it on. I was sitting here talking and trying to text you, and the audience probably picked up on my distraction. I was trying to make sure that you were getting through and on the air. So we're happy to have you.
Yeah, thanks. I'm sorry about that, and greetings to all your listeners out there. And happy Army birthday, for that matter.
Well, I really hope that you're toasting the Army. She's a pretty 241 years old. She doesn't look a day over 240.
Yeah, unlike myself. I do. I have an IPA in hand. I'm doing just that, my friend.
Well, I'm happy to hear that. I'm broadcasting live at Fire and Ice Pizza in Georgetown, Texas. They provided me with a fine local brew called the Wrench Brewery. So I'm enjoying that and celebrating her tonight. I say her because I'm a member of the Queen of Battle. So I always refer to the Army as her versus him. Just,
well,
you know, for those field artillery
you,
guys.
But I'm an Army guy now.
So tell our listeners a little bit about your career. That way we know a little bit more about you before we get into the book stuff.
Oh, sure. Well, let's see. In 1987, as an unguided senior in high school, not knowing what the hell he was going to do with his life, about halfway through the year, I went down and did the delayed entry program, enlisted in the infantry. I was lucky enough to get stationed down in Fort Polk, Louisiana, which, and I'm not being facetious, it was the only base that had a drinking age of 18, still valid in the continental United States. Did about a year down there as an infantryman, and was lucky enough to get accepted into prep school for West Point. And a year later, I ended up making it into West Point. Graduated by the skin of my teeth as a civil engineer, was way in over my head, I can tell you that much, and went off to commission as an armor officer. Did the standard rigmarole of tank platoon, company commands, various staff jobs as an armor guy. Let's see, went and taught the Armor Advanced Course as a small group instructor, taught ROTC, Texas A&M for a couple
years.
Oh, there
you go, Giga.
Well, ended up, not a grad myself, but I can tell you, after spending a couple of months down at Texas A&M, I realized potentially I had made a big mistake by going to West Point. I'd tell my cadets that all the time, just based on the atmosphere that they got to experience on a daily basis down there. But So
you're actually saying the Corps cadets rivals in awesomeness the cadet corps at the United States Military Academy.
Rivals is a relative term, but yeah, I would underwrite that statement. Sure. Yeah.
Man, what an interesting perspective. I've had the pleasure of serving with both Aggies and West Pointers, and there's a little bit of rivalry there, but one obviously like militarily, holds himself higher than the other. But, living in Texas and being a Texan, by choice, there's a warm spot, for the Maroon here. A very warm spot.
I could only imagine. And like I said, I was pretty envious of the cadets down there. If I had been smarter and made different choices, I'd have been lucky enough to be an Aggie. So...
So you enjoyed the transition from being enlisted to the prep school, quite the accomplishment, and that's like that's the hard road, right? There's the easy road, there's the green to gold road, and then there's the I'm going to go to the prep school so I can get into one of the hardest institutions in the United States. What a way to go! But as an infantryman, did you have your EIB when you were on those hallowed grounds?
Other guys look at you and like testing by about a month. So now I missed out on that before I went off to prep school.
But you still had a little bit under your belt that they didn't have, and you had probably a little different military understanding, right?
Yeah. So I think in many regards, if I had not been prior service before I went to West Point, there's a good chance I never would have made it out of there. Being prior service and being enlisted really gave me the tools and the confidence to you know, to cope with or to compete with, arguably, you know, all those high school football quarterbacks and presidents of their respective student faculties, among other things. You know, I didn't have any of that. But, you know, I was a fire service infantryman, and that really gave me a lot.
So from there, you know, going and becoming a tanker, you know, I mean, that's a little bit of a culture shock, but I imagine it was also like an easy transition. You probably had a great understanding of the combined arms fight. The battlefield probably opened up to you a lot easier. You understood the rules of each better, and I'm assuming like you had a pretty good time, a fun time. I mean, you know, PL times and stuff with big guns and fast moving vehicles. I mean, who can complain about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that was one of the things that really drew me to the Armored Corps was the speed of combat. Not that we were necessarily lethargic in the infantry, but the speed that you're able to close with the enemy in the Armored Corps and subsequently as a cab guy, you know, had a certain appeal to it. So couldn't complain about that.
Any cool assignments with the cab or with the Armored Corps?
Let's see, I was an XO almost 3 years in Fort Riley for a while. Went over to Iraq towards the end of the surge there in 08. A couple years later, I was lucky enough to get selected to be the J3 down at Guantanamo Bay for a couple of years. So
oh, wow.
That was very interesting, kind of a unique environment, if you can imagine, keeping an eye on our little jihadi buddies down there. But and certainly a great experience.
Yeah, you know, like the diversity of that, you know, is pretty cool. You know, going from the surge where you got, you know, a saturated battlefield picking guys up and trying to get them to Gitmo to like going to Gitmo and being saturated, trying to, you know, deal with all the shenanigans down there. And I imagine that was
right.
A challenging.
Shenanigans is an apropos term, certainly.
Yeah. I always like, you know, I've met National Guard guys that did rotations down there. I've met active duty guys from multiple forces that did rotations down there. And it just seems like that was an extremely challenging place to work. A big fishbowl, a lot of international press, and, you know, a limitation on what you had to work with as well. Because, you know, like your hardcore, you know, good war fighters are out, you know, fighting the war. And leaders that are great leaders are being selected to work down there because they need strong leadership. So I imagine it was a challenging time for you.
Yeah, you know, I feel for those MPs, those guards that did it day in and day out and really had to face the enemy and have no doubts that even behind the walls, you know, in many regards, they were still the enemy and they were still pushing the fight. So, yeah, I felt for those guys that spent many hours coping with it. Right, it is a fishbowl. It's a darn tough assignment, and there's you know, a very strong trend of soldiers and sailors that come out of that assignment having undergone quite a bit of stress. Many of them confess the stress that Gitmo, being part of the Guard Force there, was greater than that they experienced. So, yeah, hats off to those guys.
Yeah, I've heard that too. So, like, with that kind of spectrum of experience, you've written this new book, the Iron Major's Survival Guide. You know, I guess from what I've heard, this is this book's a great guide map to getting through it without committing career aside. You know, I think everyone that's been in leadership has stepped on something personal, maybe an appendage of their own several times. So, like, tell us about this. It's obviously not, I'm not going to read this and become a general officer,
sure.
But tell me what it's going to bring into the lives of those that read it and the motivation for you to do it.
Well, you know, let's see. So I taught a couple of years at the Armor Advanced Course. Like I mentioned, taught seniors at Texas A&M preparing to go out and be platoon leaders. And I also did 2 years teaching tactics at CGSB. And I think one common thing, especially teaching captains and teaching majors, one thing that was pretty common is it's a great curriculum. You know, it's a great program of instruction in our professional military education. But we spend very little time actually preparing for that next fight, you know, that night fight that's coming up. They're going to graduate in a month, and they're going to go out and be company commanders. They're going to go out and be battalion XOs or battalion S3s. We don't talk necessarily about the nuances of those challenges in the schoolhouse. You know, we talk a lot about tactics and the decision-making processes and, you know, the intellectual standards and fighting a counterinsurgency and creative thinking, critical thinking, all very, very important things that, you know, to teach people, you know, how to think more than what to think. But, you know, in so doing, you somewhat lose the bubble on getting these guys and gals ready to kind of step out in the force and execute, you know, hit the ground running versus the movement to contact approaches. Let me grope around blindly in the dark and figure this job out. You know, so God knows I've stepped in enough piles of career too. You know, so what I really wanted to try to do with these folks is kind of capture those pitfalls, capture those techniques, tactics, and procedures that would allow captains, majors, frankly, any staff leader to really get out into the staff capacity and hopefully take off at a brisk run. And also, I think in many regards, our culture, when we get on staff in any capacity, we kind of throw our feet up and we say, hey, you know what, I'm a staff chogi. You know, I get to manage, but I don't have to.
Truth.
And we punt on the whole leadership piece. So this book is kind of like to try to re-vortize, reorient us, make us realize that it's another opportunity. And one, frankly, you're going to spend two-thirds of your career doing, being on one staff or another. Don't forfeit the opportunity to lead soldiers and troopers, you know, in those capacities.
You know, one of the things
is, if we don't, guys tend to bail. Guys and girls will bail out of the military based on bad experiences they have on staff.
Yeah, no, like, as soon as you said that, it reminded me of, you know, we were in Iraq roughly around the same time, 07 and 08. You know, I was one of my tours there, and we had some staff officers come in that, you know, they were, we called them the Jedi Council, because there was this posse of guys that got, you know, the IRR letters and got brought back. And one of the things they said, you know, one, they were obviously slightly angry and felt like, you know, they were getting the short end of the stick. But, you know, one of the guys, well, there were two guys that really stood out. One guy embraced his situation and just really was head and shoulders above everybody else because, you know, like, he didn't get in the tank. And it just reminded, what you just said reminded me of something that, you know, he shared, is like, you know, just because we're in a staff role doesn't mean we're not leaders. And, you know, there's an expectation of leadership, you know, within our tasks and what we do. And man, it just really, what you just said resonated with me. It just stood out because, you know, how quickly, myself included, you know, I got very, you know, obviously being a non-commissioned officer, you know, once I got past, you know, what I thought was leadership, meaning hands-on Joe and, you know, like stepping off with them and being in the front or the middle of the formation versus being in the back with, you know, the beans and bullets, you know, like, you know, I really felt like, you know, I was failing at leadership. Like I wasn't doing it. And, you know, like that's just a different type, and you still are required to lead, and there's an expectation, and you can't get in the tank and think because, you know, that's where you're at. You know, your life is different. It's changed. You're still a soldier, and you still got to lead.
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, it's, you spend all that time kind of managing staff and managing soldiers on staff, but we, you know, we still have that obligation to lead those guys, care for those troopers, look out for their professional well-being, among other things. So, you don't get caught up with writing PowerPoint slides and generating memos and crap. For the sake of those great opportunities to continue to, you know, to lead soldiers on a daily basis.
So I know your target audience is those like in that staff position, but there's a lot of, you know, preparatory stuff too, right? Like to kind of help the junior officers as they're starting to cross threshold or help understand the situation of their superior, right?
Yeah, I think there's a lot more application than just those guys that are about to go out and be battalion field grades or senior captains that can go out and take a staff section. I think it certainly complies to any NCO that's going to be in a staff capacity or any NCO or officer that's going to be in a leadership capacity. There's anything, there's techniques in there from, you know, the fundamentals of here's not to screw up when he readily goes off to, you know, the what I call the calculus of, you know, the building relationships and how your reputation matters and really define your career for the next decade and a half or so. So I think it really can apply to, you know, just about anyone that takes a potential career in the military seriously and wants to, ultimately wants to make themselves better and make their units better.
The how long did it take you to put this together? I know you've been working with Kelly Krieger there at Greybeard Books, but from start to finish, how long has this process been? What's the process been like for you?
Well, shoot, when I was teaching at CGSC, you know, I would just kind of jot down notes on these stickies, and then I would go back to my cubicle and realize that I had a collection of, you know, 30 or 40 darn stickies sitting around there. So I consolidated and created a couple of open source documents that I pushed out to, you know, to my students, posted them on S3XO, among other things, used to be on Army Training Network, to just kind of push the force along. So that was probably a little 18 pages longer, and it swelled up to 32 pages. You know, over the last couple of years, especially after I engaged with Kelly Krieger, it's been swell to become upwards of about 200 pages. So, you know, I would submit that plus or minus it probably takes me about three and a half years to really put together. And every assignment I step into, I learn more. Yeah, I've been in the Army for almost 26 years, but I don't stop learning, especially, you know, especially when you're faced with those bad leaders out there. You know, it really kickstarts one's writing when you get faced with a bad leader at some point. But
the which is really sad, because, you know, we should really document the success stories more than the failures, right? But it seems that we typically fail to learn some of the lessons from the success stories that we are totally captivated by the failures, right?
Yeah, I think so. You know, and I got to be honest, it's somewhat of a rarity. I've been pretty happy in most regards and fortunate in my career to work for some very, very great people. There are a few exceptions, but like you say, you learn a lot from the bad ones, maybe even more so than you do from the good ones. Because tyrannical leadership, boy, it leaves a bad taste.
Yeah, no, and you know, and that's also the reason why they have those, you know, toxic command climate surveys, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what's on the agenda now? You got this book, you know, it's about to hit bookshelves here in the very near future. It's going to be on Amazon. People are going to be able to have it on their Kindles, their iPhones, and you know. So what's next for you? What's the next big step?
Well, therein lies the crux, friend. To be honest, I'm not really sure. You know, it's always been my hope, since I've published different varieties of the Army Survival Guide, to, you know, to keep people focused, to keep them down on earth, to keep them oriented on their units. And at this point, to be honest, I'm probably looking at the transition myself here in the next year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And The great ride is pulling back up to the station.
Yeah, it is, and I kind of talk about that in the book too. So it's not just, hey, let's be good on staff, but, you know, here's some pitfalls and things that led to my own demise. So hey, you great officers, NCOs out there, you take note from this guy, because he's not going to be pinning on any stars anytime soon. So in some regards, it's my final manifesto.
Hopefully
provide
not
some cautionary tales to the audience.
Hopefully not written with, you know, a black hoodie out in the woods of Idaho somewhere.
Oh God, no! positive only.
You're in the D.C. area now. You're gonna retire out there and try and keep that city clean, or you're gonna go back to from whence you hailed and, you know, impart great things on the society of the community you're from.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Keeping D.C. clean is a pretty tough endeavor. To be honest, I've got the range bands wide open here. So I've just kind of embarked upon this transition journey and doing things like trying to figure out how 26 years of military service looks like on a resume, among other things. So, you know, in and of itself, it's a big challenge. And, you know, maybe the next book will be something that talks about how one either successfully or fails to successfully transition into the civilian sector there.
Well, speaking from a guy that's you know, nose planted, you know, coming off of active duty into the civilian world, and then, you know, taking a little bit of time to figure it out, and then finding my entrepreneurial legs and, you know, standing up straight. You know, there's, you know, it's an interesting world. You think that with everything that you have on the resume, that people are going to be beating down your door, you know, to hire you. But, you know, the fact of the matter is you got to go out and beat down some doors yourself. You know, you got to embrace things that, you know, the Army told you never to embrace, like social media, you know, which for me, you know, was a bit of a challenge because, you know, being an infantry guy, you know, like I'm all thumbs. But apparently that's good with an iPhone. The you know, you got to get out there and, you know, get on the LinkedIn. And, you know, there's some amazing communities on the LinkedIn, you know, for transitioning guys and, you know, of all different levels. You know, they find themselves going from staff positions to, like, project management positions. And, you know, it's everything that you think it is, it's not. And everything you think it's not, it is, right? You know, the ACAP guys, you know, I always, like, you know, tell my soldiers and friends as they're transitioning, you know, the ACAP guys, they're about 5 years behind what's actually going on. And let's not forget that they have a job that's still on the teat. You know, like, they actually haven't gone out and done something. So, like, don't trust everything that ACAP tells you, because they might not be the end all be all. So,
yeah, and you mentioned a couple of good forums, you know, LinkedIn. There's some great, you know, veteran support forums on LinkedIn, among other things. So you're right, to kind of give you some current situational awareness about the trends out there in the real world.
Yeah, no, I've actually thought about, like, writing about some of the transitional pitfalls, like, on your LinkedIn, like, don't have a picture of yourself in uniform.
Yeah,
you know?
Either that or doing keg stands. Yeah, it's
right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it depends. Like, if you're applying for a bar job, keg stands. But really not. You know, the simple thing is we want to, like, rest on our past laurels and glories. But, you know, in the big picture, employers, they don't want your past glories and laurels. They want you to be who you are and what you're going to be. So, Dave, man, I really appreciate you you coming on the show tonight. We're excited to push your book out there. And, you know, we'll have you back on in a little bit. And as always, we're open to you with the transition, and we're just excited for your book to come out. And, you know, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, Toby, thanks. I really appreciate it. And I know a great percentage of your audience are military or former military, so a shout-out to all of you folks out there and who have really struck out to choose the noblest of professions in one way, shape, fashion, or form. You know, I thank you for all you've done and what so many of you do day in and day out for your troopers and your units and ultimately your respective services. You know, I truly wish you and yours the very best of luck, and I think you are the real and best 1%er, you know, of this great country. So thanks, Toby, and cheers. Cheers to you and yours.
Thanks, Dave. Have a good one. And everybody, you can find his book on booksbyveterans.com, and we'll have the links and everything posted up, and we'll keep it updated for him in the future. So, Dave, thanks for coming on. Have a great night.
Yeah, cheers, Toby.
Now, we transition from the enlisted / commissioned side of the house to one of the scariest looking enlisted guys I've ever met. He's crispy by nature. He's suave by style. He's taller than I am, so, like, I have to, like, put in a couple bunny foo-foo references. He is my five-toed brother because he's only got five, but he's my main man, Sergeant Omar Avila. What's going on, my brother?
What's up, brother, man? Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, I know you're out having dinner with your girlfriend, and you're probably hiding in some bathroom stall, like, pretending like you got something important going on, so we appreciate your time. But happy birthday to the Army to you.
Yeah, definitely. Happy birthday to the Army, man. And, you know, happy birthday to a very, very good friend of mine, Medal of Honor recipient, Specialist Ross McGinnis, who's one of my soldiers. So today's his birthday, so I just gotta throw that out there.
Yeah, man. Glad that you did. In fact, tell us a little bit about him so that our audience never forget about Ross.
Yeah, Ross McGinnis was, you know, one of our soldiers. He was a 19-year-old kid out of Pennsylvania who got stationed with us in the 1st Infantry Division in 1-6 Bruce Vader in 2005. along with the patrol, an enemy dropped a hand grenade in the vehicle. And the first thing that every gunner is about to do is jump out of the vehicle and seek safety once the grenade dropped the vehicle. Well, he ended up grabbing his grenade, similar to Grinch's back in the radio, to save everybody inside the vehicle. And, you know, he gave his life and saved everybody inside. And for that, he was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor at the age of 19.
Man, that's just strong, amazing stuff. The, you know, how quickly we forget, you know, as warfighters, some of, you know, what has happened around us and the guys that rise up, you know, the guys that you never think, it's the young guys, right? It's these guys that you discount. And they in that moment step up and do something that we can't even fathom. And that's knowing what we know. So, man, we must celebrate that such men like Ross live. We must celebrate.
Yeah, definitely, man. And you know what the interesting was? You know, when we were training, you know, we were doing some glass house training, and somebody threw a Coke can in the glass house, and he immediately jumped on it and yelled grenade. And, you know, all the NCOs were like, get up, McGinnis, I didn't jack that. We never got to that.
Yeah.
And, you know, little did we know, he actually would do save a lot of lives.
Yeah. That's amazing, man. Like, and thanks for sharing that. You know, we need to remember these guys more often. You know, we just came through Memorial Day, and, you know, for a quick second, you know, everyone knows like what's going on in Memorial Day, but you know, it's good to, you know, constantly remind people that such great men lived and do stuff. But the reason we had you on is you are a busy dude, man. You and I, we've gone hunting together. We, you know, have been known to share a beer together, the love of motorcycles, a passion of writing. But man, you have been, just this year, you've been in Alaska. Where else have you been, man? Talk to the audience about where you go and what you do and who you do it for.
Oh, man. This year, I've been to Alaska. I actually got to speak on behalf of, or I got to speak in front of the SCI, the Spark Club International fundraiser that they have every year. It's one of the biggest in the country. And, you know, I was honored and I was brought up to go speak for them. Man, I've been to Canada to go speak to their wounded soldiers. I forgot to tell you about that, man. I was in Canada shooting your troops or your.
What did you say to, like, what words of wisdom did you impart on my brethren?
Oh man, I told them to drink a lot of beer and, you know, just go out there and slay it every day.
Yeah. And they're like, we actually drink on deployments.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was.
Did they call you lightweight?
They did, man. I you know what? I give it to them. I couldn't really hang with them, man. I was struggling a little bit.
My people.
Yeah, man. They can drink. No, it was. You know, I got the chance to go up there and speak to their wounded troops and kind of encourage them on going out in the outdoors and you know, just living life, not to keep having those thoughts of suicide and feeling like everybody doesn't care about them and whatnot, but to go to the outdoors, enjoy the outdoors, and, you know, get in touch with themselves and with nature, and that there is hope out there, you know, that we can overcome any obstacle in life and be successful and be happy and be a positive role model and impact in the community.
You know, like, dude, that's great stuff. Like, right now, you know, one of my best friends, Chad Robichaud, he has the Mighty Oaks Warrior Programs. They actually have one or two Canadian wounded guys going through the post-traumatic stress program down in California. And just super excited that, you know, there's more of this wounded community than just Invictus Games, right? People think that, you know,
yep,
like, we don't communicate outside of, like, some kind of sporting competition, but you know, like, we're deeply entrenched with what happens, you know, in the United Kingdom. You know, we're affect affecting change within the Canadian system. And it's, you know, not only were we called upon to lead on the battlefield as kind of like the coalition leader, but, you know, we're called upon as like the community to support our brothers, right? As iron sharpens iron, man sharpens the countenance of man. And it's great stuff, man. I'm super proud of you for doing that. I'm proud of like a lot of things, but you know, you work with some great organizations. You still with Faraday's Troops First?
I am. I'm still helping them out and, you know, doing some liaison work for them as well. But you know, it's kind of like what you said, man. It's you know, when they called and asked if I wanted to do this, I was like, most definitely. You know, these are our brothers that went down range with us. You know, not necessarily with me. I didn't get to serve or do any combined missions with Canadians, but I got a lot of friends that did. And you know, any brother of my brother is a brother of mine. So I felt like it was something I needed to do, and you know, go speak to them, man. It's one team, one fight, you know.
So you've been active with them, active with Veteran Outdoors.
Yep.
Now you've kind of, you know, one of the things that always impressed me, you know, like anytime someone asks me if I know you, they call you by a couple of different names, you know, from the different communities that they might know you from. But one of the things, yep, like I always remind people is that, you're a power lifter, man. Like you like slinging, you like slinging iron. And I remember, you know, because, you know, you really, one, are challenged with your ability to grab the bar due to, you know, the extent of your injuries. You know, we make fun of your crypt grip, as we like to call it. But you don't have the ability to grasp the bar like everybody else. And, you know, you have this missing foot thing going on. And they said that you didn't qualify to be in the adaptive sports in the Paralympics. And you went on and competed in the regular powerlifting and won. You're world champion. And you, like, said, screw you, disability. Screw you, stigma. I'm Omar. Hear me roar and watch me lift this, you know, even with, you know, what you consider to be functioning, which clearly isn't. And, man, I always like sit back and be like, yeah, he's a lot of things, but let's not forget world champion.
Yeah, man. I was definitely, blessed with that. It was one of those things where, you know, I don't like the word when people tell me I can't do it. I hate the word can't. And, you know,
it's a cuss word, man. It's a cuss word.
It is, man. You know, it's a bad word. I really don't like it. You know, it was a couple of years ago, and, you know, all my friends were like, man, you need to do a competition in Dabber Games. It's based for wounded guys, and I think it would do great. And so, you know, I decided to take that, the challenge on, and I get there. And now, keep in mind, this is a sport that it's made just for adaptive guys. And, you know, the moment I got there, they told me that I was too injured, which, you know, that didn't make any sense to me. I'm like, this is a federation that you've made for adaptive athletes, and you're telling me I'm too injured. it rubbed me off the wrong way, man. And you know, I said some words that I probably shouldn't have. I had to keep my composure right. Cause, you know, I flew to Oklahoma out of my own dime and paid my own way, just like any other athlete does. And, you know, when I get there, and this, it was kind of a slap in the face for me, but, you know, it was one of those things that said, you know what, I need to overcome this obstacle and I need to strive. So
she said, screw Oklahoma, I'm going to Vegas.
Exactly. So, you know, and it was like the next day, the competition was going on in there at the same time. So I flew Oklahoma, made it to Vegas, and then it was stressful. If anybody out there that's listening knows what the power of the community is, you know, we got to have a certain amount of grace rest before you lift. I was cutting weight and perfect weight as I was flying to Vegas, so that means no food, no water, nothing. And I finally got there and we spoke to the gentleman who was in charge, and he said, "Dude, you're always welcome in this sport. Let's see what you got." And motivated me and ended up doing the favorite category that they had, and first first place in bench and deadlift, and ended up breaking not the world record but a national and a state record. So it's they're on the strongest grip in the world right now under that federation.
So now are you like are you still riding on the Clash Daily?
Yeah, from time to time I do get on there and write some articles. No, just with the training and all the other things I got going on, the speaking, it kind of keeps me pretty busy. So whenever I get a chance, I do get on there and I write.
It seems like you always have a great answer or a great comment on some of the polarizing issues. I'd be remiss. You and I do a lot of gun shooting together. You're great friends with, the guys from Truth About Guns. And, what's your quick take on the response to Orlando that happened over the weekend?
You know, man, it's another thing. Everybody, president's so quick to blame guns. It's guns. You know, what they don't realize is, every major gun owners have over 2 million guns and about 4 trillion rounds of ammo. Like, seriously, if you wanted to know that guns were a problem, you'd know them. And it's just, you can't call it state of state, and it's what really upsets everybody. You know, here we have a Muslim terrorist who committed a terrorist crime, and you can't call it that. And right off the bat, it's a gun. You strict gun laws. Well, let me guess what? Your home state, they have the strictest laws, yet there's more killings there than there is overseas every month.
Yeah, the number of casualties, both wounded and, expired over, the Memorial Day weekend was ridiculous. Those numbers rival last weekend's numbers in a single incident. So the control of guns, if someone's intent on doing something, they're going to find a way to do it. As young men, trying to figure things out, the revolutionaries, they turn to things like the Anarchist Cookbook. Now the kids are getting on Google, Bing or whatever, their search engine is. If they want to get it and they, they'll get it. What they can't buy in a store legally, if they're not capable, they can buy on the market. What comes across our border every day, I know you're from the Rio Grande Valley. I know you live in the capital of Texas, the Republic now, but, you were born and raised in the Rio Grande. You know exactly what comes across that border and how porous it is.
Almost definitely.
And, so it's
most
like,
definitely, man.
This term that keeps getting thrown around, common sense, it's like, I feel like the guy in, Ignacio Montoya in The Princess Bride. I don't think you know what this term means. I really want to, I'm in honor of you being on the show tonight. I'm repping some Rogue American Apparel. I actually have a really cool American Savage shirt on, Austin. So I'm pretty excited that you've partnered with these cats. You're kind of leading the charge with the Disciples of Irons. There's no better person to do it. Tell us what you all got going on with Disciples of Iron and what's it like working with old Wes Whitlock there.
Oh, man, it's an amazing feeling. It's kind of, he's a veteran himself. He's a Marine, former contractor, and an incredible line of work. It's an everyday lifestyle. not only for military, but for the law enforcement community and for the American people that, you know, support the Second Amendment, support what we stand for. And, you know, one of our biggest things is stand for something. So, you know, that's pretty much what we do over there. And, you know, Disciples of Iron is just, it's what it is. It's Disciples of Iron. It's, you know, it's about lifting weights. It's about guns. It's about knives. Riding motorcycles. Any type of iron that, that inspires you and gets you out, that's what we're about. You know, that's the lifestyle. It's getting out there and handling business and, you know, just living it up and being, you know, being a savage, man. Pretty happy to be a savage, you know, we can be and not let anybody else hold us back.
Well, I'm excited to get back out on the road with you. You know, now that we're in the same location, we really need to spend more time with each other. Unfortunately, like I travel like you travel, and we just need to do a better job. But Omar, it's always a pleasure. Yeah, talking with you. I feel like our time's getting cut short. But, man, tell everybody where they can find you, where they can follow you, and, you know, let's help your build your audience base here.
Yeah, man, I'm on Instagram. If you go at Instagram, it's at Grun11B. You'll find me under there. You can just type in Christy, and my name will be the first one to pop up. and then on Facebook as well, I'm under Omar Vila, so it's not hard to find me.
Well, are you gonna? What do you got coming up? Anything big coming up? You know, in the near future?
Yes, man. So next month I have. One of the to me, this is the best powerlifting meet I'm gonna do. It's not for any world record titles. It's not for anything. So I was contacted over the phone if I wanted to do this powerlifting meet. It's called Redemption, and they benefit a nonprofit for kids.
Okay.
So this powerlifting meet is for. So I became a big brother of a young little a little girl, 7 years old, and she's suffering from leukemia. And a lot of disease that's tearing down her immune system, and she is she's terminal. So her days are counted, and every single these days are counted. And you know, Hope for Kids, what they do is they raise money. Not only do they do a big like a big trip for the family, but they stay involved so that kid eventually, you know, sadly passes away, and they continue to help the family in the grieving process. You know, I got a call. This is an invitation to powerlifting meet only. This is not you sign up for it and you can go and get exposure. You got to be invited from the community to attend this. And I was lucky enough that they looked at my social media. They said, this is the type of guy that we need. So I got invited. And, you know, I had to make a decision because around the same time, it's the powerlifting meet that I was going to do in Vegas. I was going to put my number clips again. And, you know, when they call me and tell me why, I told the guy I was coming back. So I sat in my truck and, you know, I prayed and I asked God, you know, what should I do? I called the guy back. And, and as soon as he picked up the phone, he's like, I understand if you can't make it. Well, we can do the next one. I'm like, whoa, what do you mean? He goes, you're not calling me so many times. But no. He goes, oh, man, these are the people that call right back. So they always tell us they can't make it. And I said, man, Scott, I'm actually calling you back because I prayed about it. And as I was praying, I saw the face of my nieces and nephews who are perfectly healthy and are going to live a long life, God willing. And these kids, you know, they're not going to be on this earth for long. And there's no reason why I shouldn't be there. There's no reason why I shouldn't live for them and motivate them. So July 7th through the 11th will be in Minnesota. Lifting for Hope for Kids and hopefully putting on a show for these kids. I'm going to go for the numbers that I've never done. I'm going to try to bench 500 and I'm going to try to lift up.
Man, that's awesome, bro. Like, sometimes you got to say no to great things, say no to good things so you can say yes to the best of things. And you're constantly an example of that. Everyone look Crispy up on Instagram. And we got to wrap things up. Another great show. Omar, thanks for coming on. Thanks for all that you do. We're going to have you back on here in the very near future. Excited to hear more about it, and prayers go out to the little girl that you're supporting. Everyone, thanks for tuning in, and be sure to check us out on Facebook, Stu and the Nun, and everywhere else, Twitter, follow, and we'll have a great week, and we'll see you. Happy birthday, Army. See you next week.
Thank you for tuning in to Stu and the Nun tonight. We're always grateful for our listeners, both live and those who check us out in the archive. Be sure to check out our website at www.stuandthenun.com and like our page, Stu and the Nun, on Facebook, and follow Stu and the Nun on Twitter. And of course, be sure to join us again next week and every week here on blogtalkradio.com/Stu and the Nun every Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern. You all have a good night.